from a certain perspective, our life is kind of short. Something of which Buddha reminds us with some frequency. So there's that expression, practice as though your hair were on fire. It doesn't seem to be an expression designed to make us very calm. But I think, you know, as usual, the idea is not to waste time. If, in addition to practicing as though our hair were on fire, we could also be calm, that would be really good. I guess, I gave the talk last week and I was sick then, and I'm giving the talk this week and I'm sick still. So it's been a little difficult, a little bit challenging. Usually I'm not sick this long, so this illness is hanging on quite a while, and I haven't been sitting very much. So the kind of familiar and comforting cycle of practice, morning and evening, has been a little bit disrupted. So, but that's also been useful, because it's sometimes important to look at, what is practice like if you don't sit? And that's actually, at some point, becomes quite important. Not that people should not sit, but that we shouldn't identify our practice exclusively with sitting. If we do that, then if injury or illness intervenes, we may find ourselves troubled in spirit. And also, as we have been reminded many times, practice always is initiated moment by moment where we are. Exactly where we are, whether we're on a cushion or in the street or any place. And there's a kind of calm that is born of that sort of practice, only it doesn't always look calm, and it may not always feel like the calm that we're accustomed to or think we're accustomed to. So Zazen, as Dogen taught, is thought of as the peace and joy Dharma gate. It may not feel that way. We may have to practice for quite some time before we have some inkling of what that's about, and before we realize that it's not, there isn't a particular constellation of feelings that one has which reflect the Dharma gate of repose or joy and peace. In other words, we're sitting and think, well, I don't particularly feel all that peaceful or joyful right now, so this must be, something must be wrong, or Dogen's wrong, or something. And this will quickly lead us astray. If repose and bliss don't look accessible right now, then we should probably practice some more. And the first thing we should do is to kind of let that impression or thought go away. The impression that, well, this surely isn't the Dharma Gate of repose and bliss. I'm cranky and ill. This can't be it. We should let that kind of thinking, we should not encourage that in ourselves. Because that's exactly the kind of habit, sort of habit mind, that can obscure our actual experience of peace and joy. But most of us are at least a little bit hard-headed. I certainly am. And well, for those of us who are hard-headed, the aspect of practice that is sometimes the most powerful is the sort of merciless repetition of the same thing over and over and over again. This tends to frustrate our attempts to make sure that our life and our practice has a kind of, if possible, an endless succession of inspiring moments and exciting events, which we'd select that if it were possible to do so. We would check that box and say, yes, please, I would like an endless succession of exciting moments and, notable events that I can put in my diary. I would like that, please. But usually that can't be arranged. Sometimes if our life is like that, it becomes a kind of torture anyway. You could say that the life of a military demolitions expert is kind of a succession of exhilarating moments, assuming they're not fatal. And this probably takes quite a toll on people. So instead, mostly our lives look to us as rather a kind of humdrum, nothing much interesting going on. Which of course means that we're not particularly paying very careful attention. So for those of us who have habits of mind of that sort, there is this gift of repetition, which does, in fact, grind down certain unhelpful habits, just wears them out. And Suzuki Roshi points out that if we don't approach this relentless repetition with a certain spirit, it will become very, very difficult for us. We could maybe I could see some of this when I was in Japan and at the monastery in Shikoku, and where it's like most of those places, you know, are sort of like colleges for kids. And the kids were, you know, pretty obviously, they were not really into it. Most of them were there because they were sons. These were all guys, sons of temple priests. And they were being drilled in the family business. So it wasn't exactly clear whether their inspiration to practice had much to do with the Dharma gate of peace and joy. And those kids get driven pretty hard, you know, from before dawn till long after dark, day after day. And you could kind of tell that if the, what Suzuki called the spirit of repetition, wasn't something that they'd been taught about or been able to discover for themselves, it was quite burdensome just to be there, and that they were kind of looking forward to the end of their sentence, which could be anywhere from 6 months to several years, depending on their situation. So this spirit of repetition is pretty critical to this practice. And it can be kind of challenging to come into the Zendo day after day, you know, early in the morning, and perform many of the same observances, bowing and so forth, and many of the same rituals, the same liturgical selections and so forth, over and over again. If one can't approach that with some lightness of spirit and some perception that each time, each event, each bow, each period of Zazen is uniquely new, then we can start to feel like we're carrying some weight. And then our practice will get more and more difficult and bitter. So this spirit of a kind of buoyancy, this kind of buoyant repetition, is it's not separate from the Dharma gate of joy and peace. We can enjoy that right now, if we wish. Again, if you don't see anything in your experience that you want to label peace or joy, that's not the point. That means we're still grasping for and reaching for something outside of this moment. And this is the sure prescription for suffering. So another thing that repetition does is returns us again and again to this moment. And its simultaneous richness and ordinariness. Thank you. And so when we are not sitting, if we, at some point, we don't have the support of formal practice and maybe some other practitioners to hang out with, once our practice is maturing, this kind of diamond-like quality of each moment is, I almost hesitate to say it, accessible, but something like that. So that when you are out in the street or talking with people or eating, whatever you're doing, you don't have to travel anywhere in order to be practicing in that Dharma gate. So during my illness, it was quite encouraging finally to be reminded of that. A kind of important corollary to that is to remember that peace may not be what we think it is. Joy may not look like what we've already decided it looks like. I don't know if these sparkling qualities of the moment are familiar to you, but if not, please continue your practice and please make sure to, well, I hate to say it, follow instructions, but something like that. Please note that the pointers and helpful tips and cute stories that our ancestors have provided for us contain a wealth of wisdom. And that this practice of just sitting, I guess we could call it, is kind of the heart of every practice. And if you take all of the furniture out of the room, what's left is something like just sitting. So you don't actually have to take all the furniture out of the room, but sometimes when you do that, it's kind of helpful. And you can actually see what the room is really like without all that stuff in it. And the furniture could actually be banished from the room in an instant. With the bird call or horn honking or something. That remarkable unfolding quality of every moment is suddenly right there. And it does not depend on sitting cross-legged. still sitting cross-legged is a great way to find out that peace and joy do not depend on cross-legged sitting. So that was very clever for someone to arrange that. I don't know who arranged that, but that was very smart. So here at Isanji, there's kind of a tradition of small sangha and small groups. And sometimes it's a little hard to feel the Dharma energy when there's not so many people. So I notice often that if I invite questions or comments, sometimes it's very difficult for something to get started. Sometimes it's easier if there's a bigger audience. But anyway, I invite people to ask questions or make comments, and don't be constrained by the fact that there are just a few people here.
Yeah. Thank you for encouraging us. Very helpful. And also the reminder, it was so sweet when the dove called and then the bell rang at the end of the period of zazen. Just seemed to be exactly what you're talking about. Thank you.
I just want to say I'm not exactly sure what the about the peace and joy thing and but I do
good.
Notice.
That's good.
Okay, yeah. I do notice, though, that over the years from daily practice, there's been sort of a narrowing of the bandwidth of unhelpful emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me kind of a playing field in ordinary life. I don't have, I didn't have years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives me an opportunity to celebrate the moments that I have in
mm-hmm.
You know, just simple going to work and chatting with people
mm-hmm.
comes along a lot more easily, and,
mm-hmm.
and there was a certain joyful quality to it. So,
right,
yeah, somehow getting rid of the baggage gives energy to being able to just enjoy whatever moments you do have.
Yeah, noticing that that you can actually drop the bag is quite helpful. Sometimes we feel like we're like cursed with our baggage, and it takes quite a while to realize no, we're actually carrying it. So when you let it go, things are different, and over a period of years, the body starts to wake up to that. Yeah. Yeah.
So, thank you. And when you were sick last week and this week and. Did you find it more difficult to practice when you were sick?
Not exactly more difficult. In fact, not at all. But the temptation to just goof off was extremely strong.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched much TV, not TV, but video recordings. Fell in love with this program 30 Rock. You ever watch that? It's delightful. It's delightful. Funny show. And so I would just, you know, spend lots of time staring at the TV and realizing that, oh, wait a minute, I should, you know, at some point I should, be quiet and appreciate my life, which is more like what we think of practice rather than watching TV. So it was a little hard to hit the pause button. Okay, wait a minute. Let's not watch another episode right yet. Let's just lie here and notice our breathing. And, oh, this is great. This is practice. This is very nice. And then go back to laughing at the TV show. So what was hard was not practice. It was like not goofing off too much. Because as one's experience of practice expands, the temptation to goof off gets stronger. Because like you realize actually practice is not that narrow. I used to think it was like a very, very, very narrow thing. And then you realize actually it's very, very wide, which is, makes it very tempting to just kind of, as Suzukurishi said, lie on your bed and read some interesting stories. And I don't remember what talk that's in, but he was talking about me when he said that. That is my favorite kind of life. Lie on your bed, read some interesting stories. If that's all I had to do, that'd be fine. And that's well, it's kind of goofing off. And yet, as the line between practice and not practice is perceived to be wavier than one ever thought, it can be very tempting just to kind of kick back and, you know, cruise along. So that was what was a little difficult. Not to indulge too much, but the spirit of practice or something was no less accessible than ever.
And I find that, so I don't know if it's more difficult or if my perception is that it's difficult to practice when I feel depressed or anxious. Mm-hmm. I tend to think, oh, I can't get into that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like too out there.
Mm-hmm.
I need to get rooted or something. Like if
yes.
So it's confusing to me if that's practice or not, or like I immediately want to get into a safe
mm-hmm.
kind of frame of mind so I don't kind of just go off the deep end.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, in as you were describing, for instance, perceiving a state of mind or body that was maybe depressed or anxious, I had this notion that there are already, in what you were describing, there are all these moments, you know, thousands, if not millions of moments, any one of which exhibits this spaciousness that I'm talking about. So for us to conclude that this current state of the body-mind is depressed and therefore practice is somehow less accessible is already a kind of wrong view and can just be let go of based on the teaching that we've received, which tells us that's actually not so. So, all right, maybe my perception of my body, oh, I'm sick or whatever it is, but this is more baggage and can be set down and can actually must give way to this shocking immediacy of each moment. So to think that, oh, I am a depressed person or I am a person being depressed is already kind of, it's like, well, we may have that thought, but we don't have to buy into it. We can submit that experience of ourselves to the same kind of scrutiny and analysis that Buddha prescribes for our whole life and see that actually such an experience is composed of myriad moments, each one of which has some extraordinary diamond-like quality, each one of which completely makes available practice and realization. So if our own experience doesn't bring that taste to us, then we may for a while allow ourselves to practice according to what our teachers have passed on to us until our own experience does reflect that reality. That's one way to tell the story anyway. It's true, the Buddhas and ancestors did not deceive us. They were not out to sell us the Brooklyn Bridge. Well, kind of they were, but only so that the actual nature, the true nature of the Brooklyn Bridge would become obvious to us. And then no one could sell us any bridges anymore after that. Yes.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
Brooklyn Bridge?
Yes.
Well, there is a certain deliberate sleight of hand involved in Buddhism. All of this, all of the practices and paraphernalias and sutras and all of that stuff are a kind of misdirection. Watch this hand while the other hand is actually doing the real work. Is everybody ready? Meanwhile, practice is sort of dissolving our wrong view, drop by drop. Drop like water dropping on stone. And if we start to try to concentrate on that process very much, often things get haywire. So the Buddha's ancestors misdirect our intention, with stuff to do, things to say, things to think about, clothes to wear, ways to walk, stand, lie down, and so forth. Meanwhile, the actual solvent of practice is slowly working on whatever it is it works on. Yeah.
Are the rituals themselves part of the solvent?
Yeah, sure. But strictly speaking, they're not necessary. None of this is necessary, except kind of it is, because, if we do not take on some of the trappings of a journey, it would be difficult for us to feel like we've actually left home, made a long journey, and come back again to recognize, as Eliot says, the place for the first time. We don't go through some little exercises, our appreciation may remain rather shallow. That's not always true. There's some people running around out there at this very moment who don't need any of that. I don't know so many, but I sometimes feel like I meet people who are like that. And then I sometimes feel like there are, every person's life has moments like that, that usually go unappreciated. So these, extraordinarily fresh and enlivening encounters we can have with people and animals and objects and so forth happen all the time to everyone, but they often go unappreciated. And that's maybe partly because, well, we have to make some journey. The hero must make the journey, must descend to the realm of the dead and return. And if that doesn't happen, well, that's okay, but then there's a certain quality of, the extraordinary richness of things may just remain a kind of a dim rumor and nothing more, rather than a compelling reality. Richard, did you want to?
Yeah, I do. I don't know why ritual should make a difference, but it seems to.
It's
almost
exactly.
It's almost like I'm rehearsing a role sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like motor learning. Because it kind of takes the belief system from up here and
mm-hmm.
kind of
right.
centers it
right.
somehow.
Right.
And actually works in my life sometimes when I'm just walking along, I'm thinking about the rituals and kind of like trying to get into the zone,
mm.
almost like acting or something, you know? And it kind of works for me sometimes.
Well, a lot of our practice, and I said before, is the practice of as if. I often say, well, what if what Buddha said was really, really true? Then what would we do? How would our life be? How would we act? And this practice of as if becomes more and more and more familiar to the body until it's no longer as if. the function of ritual within that context is something like you're describing. Well, I think my health is improving, so I will busy myself with finding some guest speakers, and we can hear some about some interesting other topics, perhaps, than the stuff I like to talk about, which doesn't vary very much, I noticed, so I'm sorry for that. I was going to talk about love at some point, because I was listening to a talk by another Dharma exemplar who was talking about love. I had some problems with it, actually. So I thought, maybe I'll complain about this other Dharma exemplar without mentioning any names. So maybe I'll do that with another talk. Love, it's a big deal. Big deal. Okay, well, we have lots more cookies than people again this morning, so feel free to stay. Thank you very much.